Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My special returning guest tonight is Bob Jordan, musician and author of Sentenced to Death. Bob, welcome back to the show. I had to talk to you again because we barely talked about you and music in the last show. We talked about your book.
Well, yes, I guess we did. And, you know, there's so many things to talk about.
I know.
For a little time, you know.
Well, you know, one of the things I always ask every single artist that I interview is I'm always interested in your evolution as an artist and where it starts. And so for you, you've spent a life in music in almost every single aspect of music, of playing it solo, playing it in a group. You've produced music. I mean, you've booked music. You've sold musical instruments. Where did this start? Were you a child and you were vastly interested in music? Did you come from a musical household?
No, I didn't. I was just interested in music, and my family, my mom was encouraging in any case. She gave me a ukulele and an accordion when I was really too young to even play them. But I'm self-taught in the musical part of it. But you know, I would just there's just something about recorded music that that resonated with me, and I was able to just sort of follow that. And I went to college, I went to graduate school, and yet nothing that I studied really seemed to promise me any kind of a future. And so I, rather than, say, become a teacher, I got a job in a guitar store, and I started collecting records, and then when I needed money, I started selling records, and I just met so many people in the selling of guitars to teenagers and then selling records to record collectors that and eventually I became a DJ.
Right.
And all the while I've been playing music, but I never had any, you know, desire to be a rock star or anything like that. I just, I look at music making as just a, you know, sort of a healthy human function and not necessarily a way to make money, you know.
Did you have bands when you were a teenager or in college?
Yeah.
Were you, like, talk to me about these bands, because this is the same thing I ask painters. You know, I want to know what your first works were like. Did you do any originals?
Well, my very first band was a garage band in 1965. The day I got a guitar, I went over to a friend's house who also had a guitar.
He showed
me a few things. And then we started a band up immediately before I really even knew how to play.
What was the name of the band? Do you remember the name?
They were called The Unknowns. Yeah. But really, a couple of years later, I met up with some would-be freaks in my town of Grafton, and we started a group called Jimmy and the Pigs, which was inspired by Frank Zappa.
Mm-hmm.
And we did original compositions, and it was mostly satires and parodies of existing music. We actually tried to do think of every type of genre of music and make a song that sort of poked fun at it, at the same time, you know, incorporating the cliches of that genre and so forth.
Was Zappa a huge influence on you? He was an influence on me back in the 60s.
Well, he was more than an influence, in fact, because one of my bandmates was in touch with him by letters. He joined the fan club, and Zappa actually wrote back to us.
Oh, wow.
And then he encouraged us. We sent him a reel-to-reel tape of our first practice, which is really stupid if you think about it. And he got back to us, and he invited us to meet him in Boston when he was playing there, you know, at the Psychedelic Supermarket in February of 68. And so we met him, and
wow.
He was very nice and encouraging. He told us, he told me, you know, never stop doing it. What you guys, you have a long way to go, but what you guys are doing is important, you know. And so I thought, wow. So that was all it took for me to say, I have a place here in this music world, you know.
That's it. You know, a lot of people don't realize how important that is to meet a musician that you admire or an artist that you admire at a certain point in your life. That can make all the difference.
Well, and especially somebody like him whose public persona, he was, you know, nobody would have called him a nice guy, you know. And there he was with these soft brown eyes telling us that, you know, I mean, I've later heard that his management encouraged him to be nicer to the people that wrote him and to write back occasionally. But, you know, we just thought it was total sincerity, and I still do, you know.
It's funny because we're about the same age, and I remember really finding the early Mothers album, like Absolutely Free, to be incredibly revelatory. And then I finally saw them live at Clark, and I was blown away by their musicmanship, their ability to play.
Yeah.
Was as tight as anything. It wasn't a loose, crazy band.
No. And I think that, you know, a lot of people didn't pay attention to that, and they noticed the humor and the sort of gross behavior and the funny look and all that, but beneath it was so much musicality. It was an inspiration, you know, to try to put music together that way.
Now, did you first successfully do a solo act, or were you in when was your first successful touring out as a musician? Was it as a solo artist, or?
I'm still waiting for the first success, as a matter of fact.
Now, wait a minute. I have read your excerpts from a tour diary. You've had some amazing experiences.
Well, I guess so, but I you know, the hooking up with the way it went is I was in bands from 65 to 76. Off and on, mostly based in Grafton. And somewhere along the way, I developed a bit of a solo act. And then in 1976, I had a group that was called Last Chance Oasis. I was a member of the group. I wasn't the leader. And we did all of original material, and we practiced three or four times a week. We even... for a whole summer, we had the Elms Theater in Millbury as our practice hall.
Oh, wow.
Before they opened up as a, you know, a bistro or movie theater again. They were closed for many years, and we were in there. And we were very serious, but we never could get a record deal. We had 100, 150 fans, and it never went any further. And then when the punk rock stuff started to come out, and everybody wanted simpler stuff. Our complicated Zappa-esque originals just weren't what anybody wanted, and we broke up, and that was it. I did some recording of solo material, but that's when I went to radio. I went to WCUW and became a DJ, and I got a job in a music store. And I started booking bands and helping other people, and I just dropped my own music for maybe 5 to 7 years. And then some of the people that I was booking for, Michael Hurley, Eugene Chadbourne, got me, since I was on the road with them, I ended up playing with them when they realized that I could play. And those experiences sort of gave me confidence.
Well, you have a really nice description of the travels with Eugene Chadbourne on your website.
Yes.
And one of the things I love about that, there's a great quote, is about learning about not giving a shit about what the audience might expect from them. It was a really important thing to learn. Talk to me about that.
Well, you know, Chadbourne is this personality that against all odds, has had a successful career in music, and he somehow carved this market niche among misfits and misanthropes, and there's enough of them to support a career. I mean, and so when you realize that the popular people are popular a lot of times because they embrace mediocrity, that if you can just find your own voice, that, if you build it, they will come, or something like that,
I want to pause there because you have always followed your own way more than most musicians I know or have heard of. You've carved out your own particular niche. As a matter of fact, you talk about people who are in your sort of your own little sort of part of the music world. Where did that artistic impulse come from? I mean, you just from early on, you've always played. You've always listened to something and an impulse inside yourself, which was really unique.
Well, I'm not sure, but I mean, I know that the writers and the musicians that have resonated with me have often been outcasts or cast a critical eye on what was popular. I mean, I remember that the writer Jonathan Swift to me was a revelation because of his, he attacked the powers that be, and he did it in a way that was humorous. And the idea that you can, instead of getting bogged down in this negativity, that you can take an entirely negative situation and make fun of it, that was very appealing to me. And that's sort of where I started with the music. We, in Jimmy and the Pigs, we made fun of other music, but we were trying to play gigs and get people to listen to us. But we really, we were following an artistic impulse rather than a desire to be successful,
You've also been very willing to try different things. I want to, just as an example, I want you to talk about the Invented Thing Quartet that you were part of a long time ago.
Yep. That's something that we started up at the Worcester Artist Group in 1989. And it was a combination of musicians and non-musicians. And again, it was satire. We were essentially making fun of a classical string quartet. We wore tuxedos and had music stands, but on the music stands were these squiggles, and we basically scraped through. It was a noise band, but we presented it. We had a context that was humorous, and I thought that, this is kind of cool because, there's a lot of people making abstract, sort of ugly sonic music following the John Cage example, anything can be music. And but so many of those people were deadly serious. Now, again, from Chad Bourne, he's somebody that plays in the avant-garde and presents it in a context oftentimes of songs, and then in the middle he'll go out into this these abstract improvisations. And to be able to combine this improv music and abstract music with it presented in such a context that people might actually listen to it was a challenge, and we were semi-successful in doing that. But I think that the important variable there is humor.
So you don't think it would go over if you were deadly serious?
Well, I mean, people do that, and people do. But it's a turnoff, because you can be sort of lighthearted. I mean, how else can you expect an average person to pay any attention unless you try to draw them in somehow with humanity or humor or something? And so that was that's what was unique about that group, in my opinion. I was the sort of apologist or spokesperson for the band, where, you know, and I felt like I had to apologize because some of the music was really ugly, you know. And
well, Mitch Ahern was in that band, right?
Oh, yes, he's still a compatriot of mine. Yeah,
Mitch is amazing. Mitch has been down on the show before and playing some of his created instruments.
Right.
And it's an amazing, but you know, you can talk about the humor, but actually it's an artistic tradition that goes way back to the 1920s and before.
Oh, certainly. The thing is, I mean, with everything, I just think that you can be an artist and still realize that, you know, this is not, I mean, it's not the most important thing. It's fun. It's something you do. You're not going to change the world. So, you know, if you can just make an impact on somebody, and whatever you have to do to make that impact, to me is sort of where it's at.
It's interesting because one of the things that, and I loved reading that diary of yours, and I hope you keep entering it, putting entries in it, because, and that should be a book too. You talk about, you booked a lot of acts at the Worcester Artist Group, acts of all different kinds and a lot of major, interesting acts. And one of the consistent problems was always getting people to turn out to actually experience them. And that's still a problem. No matter what kind of music you're playing, getting people to turn out is an incredible problem.
Yes. And it's one that it essentially wore me down. I mean, both financially and emotionally, just sort of preaching, just trying to bring this great stuff to town, and then having, you know, 11 people show up. It was just, after a while, I had to stop doing it because I just couldn't take it anymore. And that's sort of when I went back to furthering my own music, started right. making cassette albums and so forth. So around 92, I stopped booking and I stopped being a DJ and I started playing solo, and pretty much I've been doing that also with groups, but since 92 I've been playing off pretty much constantly and still doing it.
I know you are. And does it ever get old?
Well, there are little breaks where you think, not going anywhere. But that's one of the reasons I moved out of Worcester, to try to start a new scene. And as long as I keep learning new songs and finding places to play, I'm fine with that. I mean, I know it's not going to result in any kind of money, but you just have to let that go. And the way that the music business is structured, if you don't want to play the game, you're not going to get anything for it.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch, my returning guest tonight, and it's always a pleasure to talk to him. Bob Jordan, musician extraordinaire and author of Sentenced to Death, which I happen to think is one of the great artistic pieces of work. And I would love to actually see that performed. And we talked about Sentenced to Death before. Would you be willing to read another section of Sentenced to Death?
Sure.
I just want to expose more people to it.
Yeah, well, maybe before I read it, I should just give a little bit of a description of what it is.
Sure.
This is a book that I essentially created from my own head, in that I didn't check any references, and I tried to comb my memory for things in my universe, whether they're musicians or books or authors, that I felt was important. And I put it down in kind of a random sequence. As things popped into my head, they went down on the page. And sometimes it might appear that the comments are just non sequiturs or off the wall, and they don't really create a narrative flow. But that was part of the challenge of doing this book. And
there is a narrative flow, Bob, but it's not. But it's not linear.
Non-linear. That's right, and that's intentional to an extent. And also, it was something that the manuscript. It was created in the mid around 2005, 2006, and I had I didn't have access to the internet at that time, and I think I almost have to say that to apologize for the book in that I wasn't Googling this stuff. This was stuff that was in my head and it came out on the page.
I think thank God you weren't Googling it, because then I don't think it would ever get down. I mean, it's much more interesting. It sounds like it's coming right out of your head.
Right. Well, it was, but now you could take the book and Google every reference and find out some very interesting things. You know, I just point out a name here and there, or just a signpost, and each name that I mention to me is this huge universe that
That's
I could write a whole chapter
That's
about,
right.
but
That's
I
right.
didn't do that. I just wanted to sort of describe the periphery of the parameters of my own personal universe, which has allowed me to remain sane in a completely insane world. You know?
And it's a complex universe.
Well, but we all have them, you know.
Well, yours is pretty rich. Yours is rich. And there's a lot of literary interesting references in this book, too, I want to mention, that I found fascinating.
Well, it is confined to certain genres of fiction and a certain time period. But yes, I did go pretty deeply in my personal reading, in my personal library. I went very deeply into the mystery and noir fiction genre and the science fiction
wow.
genre of certain writers. And those are still the literature of choice for me.
Well, let's hear a little section for the benefit of the audience.
Okay. Vibraphone, vibraharp, vibes, marimba. Oh, stop me if I say anything important. Okay. Emery Cook, who, among other things, came up with a two-headed stylus for stereophonic reproduction. Authentophonic, stereomonic, new orthophonic, mirror image sound, the sound your ears can follow, marketing terms of 1958. The weather, bowel movements, what I had for dinner, will not be remarked upon unless there's something truly, well, remarkable. Remarks are not literature, Gertrude Stein told Hemingway. Retroman drawing parallels between the end of the Cold War, the end of an era in noir fiction, and Chubby Checker. A generation of young people walking or driving along in their personal phone booths. Nikki Spillane's contention that Frederick Brown is my favorite writer. This should not deter you from pursuit of Fred. However, Mickey, you can ignore. Pet peeve number 175, overuse of the word icon to describe musical or cultural figures who would have been termed minor if they were merely poets. And saying cohort, meaning only coincident along a temporal point, that is, living at the same time. But aren't we all?
Bob, do you ever perform this? Like sections of this?
Well, no, I didn't. If I want to perform, I want to do my music. I don't know.
Because, you know, I've heard, as a matter of fact, just right after you, I'm interviewing the guy who owns Henhouse Records out in the West Coast. And they do a lot of spoken word records with like jazz and interesting music background. Man, I could really see this Like, I would love to hear this. Like, I would love to hear the whole book. It just always knocks my socks off. It's amazing. Well, we're going to run out of time, and I have so much I want to talk about. I want you to mention there are many artists that you really care about and have influenced you. There's an artist, Sun Ra, who I've always loved. And you have a great anecdote about Sun Ra in your online diary there about the name of his orchestra for that night. I have it right here, so in case you can't remember, because I couldn't believe you didn't write it down.
Yeah. Well, just as I saw Sun Ra play many times in the 70s, and was always wanted to bring him to Worcester, and I just could never get it together. And I knew the agent that could get him for a reasonable price, and I finally was able to finagle a gig for them as part of a Jazz Worcester Festival at Worcester Polytech, where the college paid the fee, and we brought Sun Ra to town. But yeah, if you want
to. So, wait a minute. But we have to do this. So you were going to introduce him to the audience, and I guess what I never realized is that every time they go on, they change the name of the band.
Essentially, yes.
So
they would come up with this big long string of mathematical and scientific and cosmic adjectives, you know, to.
And Sun Ra doesn't speak to you. He spoke to his person, who then spoke to you. And Sun Ra whispers to the spokesman and says, "You're going to introduce the band as Sun Ra and the Intergalactic Cosmo Equational Solar Myth Orchestra and Chorus." And you're just sitting there, and Sun Ra's like looking like, "You're not going to write it down?" And you didn't.
I say, no, I'm not gonna. And then the guy says to Sun Ra, "He ain't gonna write it down." And Sun Ra looks under his hooded eyelashes, you know, and kind of gives me this look, saying, "Okay, he ain't gonna write it down. We'll see."
Did you remember it?
Oh, sure. I mean, it's like I almost remember it now. Sun Ra is Intergalactic Cosmo Equational Solar Myth Science Orchestra and Chorus.
Oh my God. I can't believe that. Okay, on that we have to end. That was worth the price of admission alone. My returning guest tonight, I hope he comes back again, has been Bob Jordan, musician extraordinaire, author of Sentenced to Death, which hopefully will be recorded sometime soon. Bob, it's always a pleasure.
Okay, yeah, and if you could just say that if you want to know more about the book, it's published by Arts End Books, and you can check their website, which is artsandbooks.com.
It's worth the price of admission. It's a good book. It's a good read. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.